I'd like for you to open to 1 Kings chapter 17. We had just started this story yesterday, and we're going to focus on the northern kingdom of Israel for quite a few sessions now because of the ministry of Elijah the prophet trying to keep things in northern Israel from getting too far out of control, as they are going to end up infecting the southern kingdom of Judah. And the alliance between northern Israel and southern Judah is going to be the means by which that infection spreads southward. We're about 70 or so years into the divided kingdom period. The split that happened after Solomon resulted in the northern kingdom being the larger geographic area with the larger population, and a false faith, a faith that was at first focused on the golden calves of Bethel and Dan, which were supposed to represent the God who brought Israel out of Egypt. But when Ahab came to the throne, he is married to the princess of Sidon. And at her insistence, because she's the stronger personality of the two, Baal and Asherah worship begins to eclipse or maybe overwhelm the golden calf worship. And probably it just took over the golden calf worship because Baal can also be represented on earth by a bull. Well, that infection of false faith resulted in what little bit of the true faith remained in northern Israel to have to go on the run, to have to go underground, or be annihilated. Because Jezebel, the queen of northern Israel, is on the war path against anyone that does not believe in her god Baal and goddess Asherah. Now, the god Baal is represented as the thunder and lightning god, the storm god, the rain god of the region. And his wife consort's sister, a very weird sort of mythology going on here, was Asherah, who was the queen of heaven and the goddess of fertility and the goddess of grain and abundance. And so Jezebel and all of her people believed that the rain and the grain came from their god and goddess, Baal and Asherah. So that is exactly where the true and living God attacks the situation through his prophet Elijah. So 1 Kings 17 says, "Now Elijah the Tishbite of Tishbe in Gilead," and I shared with you that sounds like he comes from a place about 10 miles east of the Jordan River, over in what used to be known as the forest of Ephraim, a notorious old-growth forest with lots of ravines and lots of pits and things of that nature. So he comes from that city across the Jordan and then over to apparently the capital city of Samaria, and he delivers a message straight from God. And this is what it is: "As he who is the God of Israel lives, before whom I stand, there shall be neither dew nor rain these years except by my word." So God effectively says, you think your God is the rain God and your goddess is the grain god, guess what? I control all of that. And I'm turning off the water and I'm drying up the grain until further notice. And so that's the message that Elijah delivers. And then, verse 2, the word of he who is came to him, depart from here, turn eastward, and hide yourself by the brook Kirit, which is east of the Jordan. Now, nobody knows for sure where Kirit is, but the word means cutting. And so it's a probable reference to the steep sides of a wadi, a wet weather stream that would be in this region east of the Jordan that has cut this trench, this ravine through the hills. And it sounds as if Elijah is told to go back to his home territory, back into the forest of Ephraim, and hide out in one of the rugged ravine areas that are located there, away from civilization, away from any of the towns. So he's out in the wilds. Now today, excuse me, by the way, there is a small remnant of this wild region that's called the Ajalon Forest Preserve, and it's north of Ajalon, Jordan. And you can get a sense from that as to how rugged and wild the entire forest had been back in the time of the Bible stories that we're looking at here. It was deforested many years later. All right, so Elijah is out in the wilds, and this is what he's told. You shall drink from the brook, that is the wet weather stream, and I've commanded the ravens to feed you there. So wild birds are going to bring him food every day. He's not going to have to look for that. And the water in the stream will be there until the drought dries up this stream. Because effectively what's happened here is God has stopped or changed the weather patterns that normally happen for this region of the Mediterranean, which is it blows moisture-laden clouds from off the Mediterranean across this area, and all that moisture drops in the central area of the highlands of Israel and provides plenty of moisture to grow things. Well, God shifts the patterns so that Judah is still getting all of that moisture-laden storm systems coming across the south. But north of the border, none of that's happening. No clouds are forming. No moisture is coming off the Med. It's just dry. And eventually, the wet weather streams, which run full of water during the rainy season, but are kind of smaller volume rivers the rest of the year, this wet weather stream will dry up. Verse number 6. The ravens brought him bread and meat in the morning and bread and meat in the evening, and he drank from the brook. So he's getting fed morning and evening, a couple of meals a day, and he's got both bread and meat. Now, where's this stuff coming from? And I'm going to just give you my own imagination, my guess that I think would be hilarious and funny. I think that these ravens might be stealing the food and the bread and the meat off of the royal tables of Ahab and Jezebel. Now, that's all my fantasy, okay? But I think it would be absolutely hilarious if God stole from these people that don't believe in him to feed the people who do believe in him. Now, we do know, and I will throw this out here, because it is clearly put in Scripture, but it's kind of the same sort of thing. One of God's people is inside the administration of Ahab and Jezebel. And he's apparently so good at his job that Ahab puts up with the fact that he's not a true believer in Baal and Asherah. That man has hidden away 100 of the prophets of the true and living God, and he's feeding them every single day out of the supplies of the kingdom of Israel. So he is, in effect, taking the food of Ahab and Jezebel and feeding it to the hidden away prophets of God. So I just guess that perhaps God's doing the same thing using these birds to feed Elijah. Now, verse number 7 tells us that after a while, the brook dried up because there was no rain in the land. Now, there's nothing to clarify exactly how long that took. We do know from later in the story and even in the New Testament testimony about this story that the total time between rain stopping and rain starting again was 3.5 years. So the water in the brook Kidroth dries up sometime well before that 3.5 year period is finished. Verse number 8. Then the word of he who is came to him, "Arise, go to Zarephath, which belongs to Sidon, and dwell there. Behold, I have commanded a widow there to feed you." Now, Zarephath is on the coast of the Mediterranean, about 8 or 9 miles south of Sidon. So it is inside Phoenician territory. And it's inside the actual kingdom of Jezebel's family. Her dad, Ethbaal, was the king of Sidon whenever she married Ahab. So we're talking about God sending Elijah to hide out in the backyard, effectively, of Jezebel. And we know later in the story that Ahab and Jezebel are looking everywhere for Elijah, because he's the one that stood in front of everybody and said, "Until I say otherwise, at the command of God, the true God, it's not going to rain anymore." And so they've been trying to find him, to force him to say the words to turn the water back on ever since he disappeared. So after he's been in the wilderness of the Kerith Brook, he now goes into apparently a suburban area of Sidon and hides out with a widow lady. And they are also suffering under this drought, where God has turned off the tap by stopping the moisture-laden clouds from coming off the Mediterranean across northern Israel. Now, Phoenicia is on the coast where those clouds would have to come across to get to Israel. So they're under the curse of God as well. Verse number 10. So he arose and he went to Zarephath. When he came to the gate of the city, behold, a widow was there gathering sticks. So he is told by God, "That's the lady that I am going to have you hide out with for a while." What's she doing? She's picking up bits of wood that she can use to build a fire with. He called to her and said, "Bring me a little water in a vessel that I may drink." And as she was going to bring it, he called to her and said, "Bring me a morsel of bread in your hand." So he, as a stranger, asks for water, which she then immediately agrees to do. Now, water is going to be a special, important commodity commodity at this time during the drought, but she is willing to share it, probably because she has been told, either in a dream or by a vision, that a guy is going to show up and ask you for some water. Help him out. Well, he also asks for some food, which is also in short supply, which makes me suspect that we're at least into the second year of this drought, because the first year crop needed water in order to fill out well. And when it failed, that would have made it very hard to plant the next year's crop, because you would have eaten up all of the supplies of whatever it was you got to harvest. And so when you can't plant, you can't harvest. And so grain becomes very scarce. And so anything they import from other parts of the world, such as Egypt, or maybe up into what we call Turkey today, Asia Minor, anything that's imported into a famine zone is going to be very expensive and hard to get a hold of for the most common of the people. So when he asks for some bread, that becomes a little more problematic. She said, "As he who is your God lives." So she knows that he is an Israeli. She knows that he serves the God called He Who Is. So she talks to him about God. I suspect it's because she's had a visitation from God. "So as he who is your God lives, I have nothing baked, only a handful of flour in a jar and a little oil in a jug." See, and that's what she needs to make bread, is a little bit of flour, a little bit of oil, mix them together, pat it out, throw it into a hot oven, and you've got bread. "Now I'm gathering a couple of sticks that I may go in and prepare it for myself and my son." So she is a widow, but she has a child that she's been feeding. She says, "I'm getting ready to go in and cook our last bit of bread. That's all that we've got. We're going to eat it, and then we're out of supplies. We'll have no other choice but to die of starvation in a few days." Now Elijah said to her, "Do not fear. Go do as you've said, but first make me a little cake of it and bring it to me, and afterward make something for yourself and your son. For thus says he who is the God of Israel, the jar of flour shall not be spent, and the jug of oil shall not be empty until the day when he who is sends rain upon the earth." So he gives her the instruction, "You're going to start feeding me now, because I'm going to live with you. You need to, out of faith," now he doesn't use these words, but this is actually what he's indicating, "out of faith in God, out of trust in he who is, you need to go and use that flour that you say is in the container right now, the oil that's in the container right now, to make me a little bit of bread first. Make it into, you know, one serving, pat it out, throw it in the oven, bake it up, bring that to me along with the water, let me eat. Then you'll go back and you'll find out that you've got enough to make a ration for yourself and your son. And I promise you, I tell you in the name of he who is, you are going to be able to do that every single day from now until the rains start. You won't run out of flour and oil for your rations and my rations of bread every single day." So what's she left to do? Well, she has to exercise her faith. She has to go and do what God's told her to do through this prophet. And she does. And that tells us something about her character, something about where she's at in her life. she's apparently looking for a relationship with the God of the universe, the God who has evidently spoken to her in some form or fashion. So she went and she did as Elijah said, and she and he and her household ate for many days. The jar of flour was not spent, neither did the jug of oil become empty, according to the word of he who is that he spoke by Elijah. So every day, a couple of times a day, she is able to make the meal ration for all three of them. And that flour jar never completely empties out. The jug of oil never completely empties out. It's just an amazing miracle. Verse number 17. Now the faith gets tested again. And it's not just the faith of this woman. It's the faith of Elijah. After this, the son of the woman, the mistress of the house, became ill. And his illness was so severe that there was no breath left in him. So he quits breathing. And she said to Elijah, "What have you against me, O man of God? You've come to me to bring my sins to remembrance and to cause the death of my son." So she does the same thing a lot of people do when something bad happens. They blame God for it. They say, "Why is God doing this to me? Is he punishing me for something? Is he remembering that I used to be a pagan, that I used to believe in other gods and goddesses and did sinful things? Is he punishing me for all of that now by taking my son away?" And Elijah's response is, "Give me your son." And he took him from her arms and carried him up into the upper chamber where he lodged and laid him on his own bed. Now, we don't know exactly how old this child is. It seems that he is younger, but we can't be absolutely certain. He could be a teenager as well, and all of these things could happen. But Elijah has his own room up on the roof. The way that they built houses back at that time in that area is generally it was a flat top, and you use the flat portion of your roof is kind of like your patio, kind of like your deck, where you could go up and be in the breeze. You might have like a little shelter up there, covered area to have some shade. Well, sometimes you'd build a little second room up there that somebody could live in. So that's where he's living. He's living in a little second chamber up on the roof. So he takes the boy up to his room and lays him on his own bed. And then verse 20, he cried to he who is, "Oh, he who is my God, have you brought calamity even upon the widow with whom I sojourn by killing her son?" So I told you that this was going to be a test of his faith. He is also making an assumption. "God, why did you do this? Why are you killing this woman's child when she's been helping me out and helping you out by helping me out?" Now, the truth of the matter is, it could be very random, because this world was immersed into sin and disease and accidents, randomness, chaos, because of sin. And that's why bad things sometimes happen to good people and good things sometimes happen to bad people. There is the random factor. So instead of blaming God for everything, we need to just simply ask him to do what is best based on the circumstances. Because Romans chapter 8 reminds us, 8:28, that God is able to make all things work together for good. I mean, even the bad stuff that happens. For those who love him, to those who have been called according to his purposes. So let's be careful not to engage in the blame game, blaming God for everything. But anyway, what happens next is He stretched himself upon the child three times and cried to He who is, "Oh, He who is, my God, let this child's life come into him again." So he is praying to God on top of this child. And three separate instances of this begging of God, let the child come back to life. So he believes that's possible with God. And verse 22, it turns out that it is. He who is listened to the voice of Elijah, and the life of the child came back into him again, and he revived. And Elijah took the child and brought him down from the upper chamber into the house and delivered him to his mother. And Elijah said, "See, your son lives." And the woman said to Elijah, "Now I know that you are a man of God, and that the word of He who is in your mouth is true." And I would count this as the absolute conversion moment for this woman. I think it is at this point that she comes to the real personal conviction. There is no God but He who is. And so her faith explodes at this point and proves that God was right in reaching out to her and offering to her the chance to act in faith by assisting Elijah during this period of time when he needed to be hidden far away from the murderous intentions of Jezebel and Ahab. And because of that, Jesus mentions her in his sermon to the Nazarenes in his hometown and says that she was a woman of faith. Why don't you come back tomorrow and we will start in chapter 18 with the end of the famine and drought.